Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
This issue about Joe Biden being on the November ballot is a major issue, so we keep talking about it, even though everybody keeps telling us it's not the crisis that it originally appeared to be. We're talking about it again today on Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn here with Lisa Garvin, Leila Attassi, and Laura Johnston, and let's talk about it. It's getting serious now. Lisa, what substance did Ohio Senate President Matt Huffman add Tuesday to what is apparently a deepening discussion on how to make sure Joe Biden is on the ballot here in Ohio this November?
Yeah, the Senate president said yesterday that talks have advanced on legislation to change that 90-day deadline to certify presidential candidates for the ballot in November. So the deadline currently is August 7th. They're discussing potential solutions with Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio, House Speaker Stevens, and also House Minority Leader Alan Russo. And Russo says that they all agreed that the law needs to be changed. Huffman says, I think it's going to happen, but not today. But he says whatever they do will probably permanently change the deadline. They want to discuss if the change can be added to existing legislation or rather than a standalone law. So they're still talking about that. But lest we forget, this deadline has been waived before for both parties in 2012 and 2020. And Ohio actually has one of the earliest deadlines in the United States for presidential candidates. It's set 90 days before the election, and Huffman says that's so election officials have time to prepare the ballot and give candidates more campaigning time. But most states have September deadlines, some even in October. And then there are some states like Texas, Michigan, and Illinois that set their deadlines relative to when the conventions are scheduled.
What was heartening in this story is it appears that Matt Huffman, the Senate president, is actually communicating, I don't know if it's directly or through intermediaries, with Stevens, Jason Stevens in the House. Those guys don't like each other because they're competing to be speaker next year, but they do need to talk to each other to get this done. And it appears they are. So that's great news, right?
Yeah. And this, you know, apparently this will hopefully just be a tempest in a teapot. But I think that they've realized that this benefits, you know, both parties. You know, we don't know when the national conventions get scheduled before they get scheduled.
All right. Well, we're going to keep watching this because we don't really trust people in our legislature. Who knows why? And until this is done and locked, we're going to be skeptical. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Remember how we had issue one in August last year and people were supposed to vote no if they wanted to preserve their ability to change the Ohio Constitution? And then we had issue one in November and people were supposed to vote yes to enshrine abortion rights in the Constitution. It was confusing to have two issue ones where people really, depending on how they felt, were supposed to vote in opposite directions. What is the Ohio legislature doing about this, Leila?
Well, State Rep Adam Matthews has sponsored House Bill 271, which would change the ballot issue's numbering system so that we don't run into that confusion again. Under the current law, ballot issues are named in the order that they qualify for the ballot, and the numbering starts over at issue one each election. Under the newly proposed system, the numbering would continue consecutively to issue 500 before restarting at issue one again. So we're far less likely to be in a situation where in back-to-back elections, voters could be considering those two intertwined issues that are assigned the same numbers. The House State and Local Government Committee voted unanimously on Tuesday to advance this bill to the full House for a final vote. There's no word yet on when that might happen, but nobody's testified against it, so that really does help. It then would have to get approval from the Ohio Senate and Governor DeWine to become law.
The idea that they're going to start at one and end at 500, I don't know. Aren't there years on the ballot where up to like 70 and 80? Seems like that might be too small a number.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I was thinking about that. How long would it take to reach that? But at least I don't think that you're going to see 500 issues on one ballot, so that the very next election you're going to be back at one, and you could have that same back-to-back elections issue. I mean, that was so confusing. Lots of folks had no on issue one in August on their front lawn, and then had to swap that sign out for the yes on issue one signs in November. I mean, you could actually just swap your sign with your conservative neighbor between those elections. That was so confusing.
Wouldn't it make more sense, though, to do it? This is 2024. So it'd be issue 24-1, issue 24-2, and then next year, issue 25-1, issue 25-2. You could separate them by the year. This constantly recycling of numbers. It's like in the legislature, you know, HB6, I would never want to introduce bill in the House if it was number 6 in the session, because it's HB6.
This made me think of that too. What was HB6 recently that we were talking and discussing? I can't remember. We're like, oh man, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like these ought to have, and this is a good move. It'll take out some of the confusion, but there's always a better way. They should have thought this through a little further.
Maybe they can retire some bill numbers like they do jersey numbers for certain players.
We can name it for legislators. We could say HB6 is enshrined on the wall and put Bill Seitz's name up there with it. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Congress successfully defeated the people who would appease Vladimir Putin in the style of the appeasement of Adolf Hitler in the 1930s with the vote to provide much more military aid to Ukraine. We know J.D. Vance is one of the nation's chief appeasers. George Will took him apart in a column that we published in the Plain Dealer this morning, and he voted against this because, you know, if he were in the 30s, he would have helped Hitler come to power. What did the rest of Ohio's congressional delegation do, Laura?
Most of they supported this, right? This is a $95 billion foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. So Vance is one of the 18 senators who opposed this package. He said he supported sending aid to Israel, but voted against it because it would send $61 billion to Ukraine. He says that war is hopeless. He believes it will further decimate the Ukrainian population. We're talking about $26 billion to Israel and $8 billion to help Taiwan counter communist efforts from China. And all of our delegates basically said, when the United States' allies are healthy, we're healthier. And the idea that we're all in this together, we've seen what happens when we try to be isolationist in this country, and it is not good for the world or for democracy.
George Will actually called him, and George Will is a conservative, he called him the Neville Chamberlain of today. And that's how ugly this is. J.D. Vance is really becoming the worst senator we've ever had. He is standing on the side of authoritarianism and totalitarianism. He wants to be Donald Trump's puppet. But my gosh, we learned in World War II what we should do when something like this happens. You never appease, and yet that's lost on him. We did have another legislator, Laura. You missed one that voted against this in the House. Who was it?
Well, okay, hold on. So Warren Davidson of Miami County, Jim Jordan of Champaign County, and Troy Balderson of Zanesville, they opposed the Ukraine aid. Davidson was the sole Ohioan to oppose Israel aid and sanctions action that included a ban on TikTok. So, yes, we always like to talk about Jim Jordan.
Distinguishes Ohio yet again, another appeaser that's like, yeah, go ahead, Vladimir Putin, take over all of Europe. The people who really understand this say that if Putin is successful there, there'll be a war between Russia and NATO within 10 years. That's what happens when the dominoes start to fall. They never stop falling, and you end up having a conflagration at some point. That's why you draw the line in the sand right up front. And we have two prominent lawmakers from Ohio who don't understand the lessons of history and would be just as happy to have Putin running over Europe. Very embarrassing, very ugly for the state of Ohio.
You know, we look at Max Miller. He's the GOP representative from Rocky River as another Trump acolyte, right? But he supported all the aid bills. He said, history has taught us an important lesson. America is most secure when our allies are strong and our enemies are afraid, which was echoed by a lot of people, including Dave Joyce and Chantel Brown. And there's a difference there. You wonder how Trumpy you have to be to side against it.
Look, whenever we bring up the 30s and Hitler, there are people on the far right that says, oh, you're playing the Hitler card. You lost the argument. That because they don't want to even look at that and acknowledge we are repeating history. There are a bunch of people in America, and J.D. Vance is kind of the king of them all, that wants to repeat what happened back then. And you just hope that people who do study history, do pay attention, prevail, as they did here. They did the right thing. Hopefully this will help Ukraine overcome this challenge. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Why does an Ohio state senator want to roll back a safety law, railroad safety law, the legislature passed in the aftermath of the East Palestine train wreck? Lisa.
Senate Bill 250 is being sponsored by Republican Senator Bill Reinicke of Seneca County. This would loosen recently adopted regulations for smaller railroad lines that would require wayside detectors every 10 to 15 miles along the track. These are cameras and sensors that can detect malfunctioning or broken equipment on moving trains. And it was among several safety reform measures proposed in a package. But smaller railroads are objecting. They say these detectors cost $200,000 and more a piece, and they say they don't need more because their trains go short distances at very low speeds. And Reinicke says these detectors just don't work on trains that are going 10 miles an hour or lower, and he said it would be better to just make track improvements and improve maintenance along these lines. And he also said these small railroads have limited resources. Some could go out of business because of this law, but there is $10 million in state grants that are available to cover the cost of the detectors. So you have like class two railroad lines, which are regional and branch lines. They would have to have detectors every 25 miles. Class three, which are short line spurs from industrial facilities, would have to have them every 35 miles. Now, Bride Rose Sweeney, who really advocated for these detectors, she's a Democrat from Westlake. She says she's willing to hear any arguments to appropriate more money. She says this isn't about, you know, trains. It's about safety.
Yeah, that seems like it's the answer. If this really would be an onerous spending bill for smaller railroads, let's help them. Let's provide the money, because the safety is the paramount here. It's not to say, oh, well, it's too expensive for the railroads. Let's let them stay dangerous. That's not the answer. So this doesn't seem like the wisest move. If they want to change the rules some, get some money. I mean, we give money to everything in this state. Why not give it to railroads?
Right. And there's $10 million already in a pot. So, you know, Bride Rosini's, hey, if we need more, let's talk about, excuse me, getting more.
Yeah, good point. You're listening to Today in Ohio. When MetroHealth announced the remake of its hospital campus a few years back, part of the vision was for a pastoral park in the center of the campus to help serve the community. So far, we don't have that park. And Layla, it doesn't look like we're getting it.
No, it doesn't. MetroHealth originally envisioned a 12-acre park along West 25th Street to serve as the front door to its 52-acre campus in the city's Clark Fulton neighborhood. But this week, top MetroHealth officials announced that that's not going to happen. That's because under the new CEO, Erica Steed, Metro has reevaluated its needs for healthcare and office space on the main campus over the past 16 months. And they decided that the old outpatient plaza building that would need to be demolished to make room for that park, that will need to stay. Its square footage is needed for administrative offices that will be displaced from other areas on the campus. And the building may also house non-medical community-focused care like the Health Systems Institute for Hope. MetroHealth still plans to weed out older buildings like the 11-story Towers building. As it does that, it will seek to improve and increase smaller park spaces around the campus. But the idea for the 12-acre park appears to be dead, and that news really caught folks in the community completely off guard, including City Councilwoman Jasmine Santana. The park was part of the master plan for the Clark Fulton neighborhood, which had been approved by the Cleveland City Planning Commission after 2 years of collaboration with the community around MetroHealth. So she felt like this was kind of a bombshell that was dropped on her, and she's disappointed.
There are two gigantic red flags for this. Yeah. One is that there was no community input on this. There was so much community input. Back when Akram Boutros was planning this thing, they were all over that community gathering input on what to do there. And this was a very cool part of the project, and it's one of the reasons I think people came behind it. There's nothing this time around. They're just not doing it. They say, well, there's an office building there that we were going to tear down, but we kind of need it because blah, blah, blah. That's a red flag. There's something wrong when you don't have a big community conversation. The second part of this that is a major red flag, they're saying things have changed dramatically about outpatient, inpatient services right. since this was designed. That's crap. This thing was designed 4 and 5 and 6 years ago. It has not changed that dramatically since then. So this thing doesn't feel right. This right. seems like this is abusive to the community. It hasn't involved full conversations. And I hope Jasmine Santana brings this up in city council, hauls MetroHealth down there for a hearing, because there was a lot of public help on this. The county taxpayers guaranteed the bonds for this project. And part of the sales pitch to the county council was, we're going to put this nice park there and it's going to be beautiful. They just pulled the wool out from under everybody's feet. So we gotta get some answers here. This is totally unsatisfactory.
It also sounds as if the sudden need for more office space in that building that they don't want to tear down now might be because of their new vision for this other building that that's in construction right now, called the Apex Building. That was originally designed to be the medical office building, but under this reevaluation of the needs, MetroHealth decided that they want to create more outpatient care there. So they're creating 70 exam rooms in that building, displacing the office space, which now I think must be what they're going to be using, that old 1992 building where the park was supposed to go. So that change in plans has really caused a lot of issues here, not only in the park that they wanted to build, but now the surrounding neighborhood is really frustrated by the delay in construction, because a new parking garage is hard for patients. The new parking garage that's south of the Glick building and east of this Apex building is really hard for patients and families to reach, and is connected to the rest of the campus only by shuttles. So now visitors are parking on local streets. That's stressing out the neighborhood. I mean, it just seems like all of this has been thrust upon a community that spent 2 years really engaging in good faith with the master plan that was supposed to be executed. And now it's just, like you said, the rug has been pulled right out from under them.
Well, and so much of this was, there was an agreement. They tore down some historic buildings that people in the neighborhood were upset about, but it was all with this promise that we're going to make this special for the neighborhood. And now, with a whisper, it's gone. I don't think this is the end of this. I should say, as a personal aside, if this saves any money, they ought to invest it in their phone system, because I've had recent experience to have to deal with that phone system. And I really, at the end of it, wanted to just pound my head against a brick wall. It is one of the least user-friendly systems I've ever dealt with. And all I could think of is, this is like dealing with a government, and it is a publicly supported hospital, so maybe that's why. You're listening to Today in Ohio. With all the talk about subsidizing childcare of late, we've lost sight of preschool, which is part of the continuum of caring for children. Ohio has long ranked among the worst at helping parents with childcare. Laura, where do we rank with preschool enrollment?
This is pretty dismal. Ohio is 36th in the nation for preschool enrollment of 4-year-olds and 26th for 3-year-olds. This is according to a new report released by the National Institute for Early Education Research. So that's overall all the kids. But Ohio serves only 11% of 4-year-olds and 2% of 3-year-olds in state-funded preschool. That's about a total of 18,000 students. It is an increase of 1,200 from 2022. But that's not a lot of kids. Now, some communities have really taken upon themselves to boost enrollment in preschool because they know how important it is for the rest of these kids' lives. If these kids enter kindergarten knowing their ABCs and their numbers and their, you know, how to write their names, they're going to be a lot more successful in the long run. And so places like Cuyahoga County have universal pre-K, and there's the Pre for CLE program in in Cleveland, and those are all to be applauded, but that's not coming from the state here. And I would like to point it out that high quality childcare includes preschool, and my kids always went to daycare to childcare, and they got wonderful early childhood education. So these are very linked problems. And obviously you can go to a preschool a couple hours every morning. Lots of churches end up hosting those in Northeast Ohio, but we're not doing enough for these kids. And it would help all of our school districts and probably a lot of other institutions if we could make sure that every kid got to go to preschool.
Yeah, when we did that project about the first 5 years of a kid's life back before the pandemic, mm-hmm. it was clear how much a pre-K and a kindergarten program can make a difference for kids. That if we do that right, the kids go to school supercharged, ready to learn, and those who don't have some catching up to do.
Right. And we're actually not the worst in this. There are 6 states, Idaho, Indiana, Montana, New Hampshire, South Dakota, and Wyoming, who don't allocate any funding for preschool programs. So at least we're not that bad. But according to this report, most states need to increase their funding per child substantially so that they can meet these minimal standards for high quality, effective education.
Okay. You're listening to Today in Ohio. We all love bike lanes and how area leaders have worked to build a network throughout the region, but one bike route in particular keeps raising safety concerns. Lisa, what's the latest concern over the Midway bike lane on Superior Avenue in Cleveland?
Yeah, I'm glad you gave me this story because I'm real skeptical about this project.
That's why I gave
it. All right. Yeah, it's the Midway bike lane we're talking about. It's a $24.5 million, 2.4-mile path from Public Square to East 55th down the center of Superior. So they're seeking public comment for solutions to a variety of issues, including truck access to businesses along Superior, parking issue, and how they're going to do traffic lights for bikes and cars. So many trucks would have to cross that path in order to back their vehicles into businesses with garages on Superior and no access off Superior. Cleveland City Planning Coordinator David Bass says they have to make sure the roadway works for everyone, and that's a big thing. So the current plan calls for bike lanes that are 12 feet wide. East of 18th Street, they will have 8-foot landscaping strips on either side, so that would be a total of 28 feet wide. There will be a single lane of traffic in both directions. Curbside parking will remain between East 18th and East 55th. 12 of 36 intersections will have traffic lights. Now, north-south traffic, though, at unsignaled intersections will be blocked, so there are some places you won't be able to turn left or right. All existing crosswalks will remain. So looking at a possible solution for trucks, they're thinking about allowing them to back over mountable sections of the midway along the landscaping strip, but they may need to back over the entire median in some areas, especially if it's a big 18-wheeler. So if you have, you know, solutions or concerns, you can certainly talk about them at an open house today from 6 to 8 p.m. at Goldhorn Brewery, which is 1361 East 55th Street. You can also find more information at clevelandmidway.com.
I'm with you on this. I just don't see this working. I'm thinking about it as somebody in a car approaching Superior from the side roads, and you don't expect it. The problem with this is it's so unusual being in the center that as bikes are going across it, you're just not thinking of that. And because most bike lanes are on the sides of the road, I would not want to be riding a bike on that up to the key intersections, because I'd be knowing that most people are unaware of this. It seems like we're really kind of shoehorning it in. I don't get why we didn't put these lanes on the sides.
Well, and the landscaping strips are problematic too, because the drawings, some of which you can see on cleveland.com, are, you know, they have these trees. So there's a visibility issue here. You know, if you're going to have tall trees or any kind of, you know, shrubbery, it's a visibility issue. And then they have to figure out how to time these. And it's similar to like that Euclid bus lane. There are times when you can turn left and there are times when you can't. And they have different signals for buses and cars. But I think that some people are just going to make a left turn and not even think about it. And I thought, how are they going to plow it? I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. And it's not cheap. I did the math. It's $10.2 million a mile to build this.
What, Well, and think about that. As you're on Superior making a left turn, you're not familiar ever with a biker coming in the same direction as you're going from your left. Mm-hmm. You're just not expecting mm-hmm. that. And I could see that being perilous. And we'd mentioned in a previous story, there's a similar thing in another city. I think it's DC. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work that well. At some point you'd think, because we keep getting these concerns on this, that we'd say, maybe this isn't the right way to go. Maybe there's a better way. But man, they're dug in and we just keep talking about it.
And I thought about, you know, the police station is going to be right along that area. I think they're going to be at 22nd and Superior, right? The new right. Cleveland police station. And so, right. And then if you're used to crossing over Superior at an unsignaled intersection, you're not going to be able to do that now. So you're going to have to turn left or right and then go back around to get to the other side.
Yeah, the whole thing, I think, is going to confuse people. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Layla, we thought we were finished talking about the Hewlett Orloaders that once defined the Cleveland Lakefront, but there's news about the big building where the Hewletts were manufactured. What's up?
Hey, yeah, you know, I'm starting to think that maybe Steve Litt is just playing a game with me where he tries to get the phrase Hewlett or unloaders into as many stories as possible. but this is real, and this is a pretty big story. Steve tells us that the city has made its first major purchase using Cleveland's $50 million site readiness for good jobs fund. And it's an immense vacant factory in Cleveland's central neighborhood where those massive Hewlett ore unloading cranes were once manufactured more than a century ago. On Monday of this week, they closed on an $845,000 deal to acquire this 10-acre property on Central Avenue that includes the 183,000 square foot Wellman Seaver Morgan factory. The next step here will be an engineering and marketing study by the nonprofit Site Fund to explore new uses that could include food, microelectronics, energy, vehicle manufacturing, or other businesses. The $50 million Site Fund is one of Mayor Justin Bibbs' initiatives. He proposed it and City Council approved endowing this fund with nearly 10% of the $500 million that the city got from the American Rescue Plan Act. And the goal is to assemble and acquire 1,000 acres of vacant or abandoned industrial sites and to create 25,000 jobs in its first 15 years to help rebuild the city and bring new wealth to neighborhoods by repurposing brownfields. Cleveland has about 4,000 to 5,000 acres of vacant, abandoned, or underused industrial property. Steve, this week, or last week, I believe, walked the site with Mayor Bibb, who seemed very impressed with the size of this place, which has been inactive as a factory since 1970 and completely vacant for decades. The revitalization of the site is intended to create walk-to-work jobs that align with Bibb's vision of turning Cleveland into a 15-minute city. That's a city where all the basic necessities can be found within walking distance. And Steve says that while the building is in really, really, really rough shape, it's pretty much intact, including the roof. So it hasn't really suffered the kind of extensive water damage that other abandoned factories have. It sounds like a pretty good get for the city.
Yeah, I don't know. I drove past that building for years, and it is one unusual and imposing structure. And my favorite part of this story was seeing Steve Litt's pictures of what it looks like inside. He has pictures of Brad Whitehead going upstairs and wandering around. And I was always curious, what's in there, this hulking building? And it's largely gigantically empty because the Hewlett Orloaders were enormous and they needed all the space. But reusing a building that's of that shape and that size, good luck. And I'm not sure what you can actually put in there without significant expense. It's great they're trying to do something because it takes up a ton of space at a key intersection in the city. It's at Central, right near 55th. But it's good to get a status on what's going on with it.
It does feel like that site is in such rough shape, and the uses that they're considering for it would require, like you said, such an overhaul. Wouldn't it just soak up the entire site fund that they've developed so far? I mean,
right.
I don't know where they would get the money to do that. I know that the site fund would seek a dollar for dollar recovery of expenses for whatever role it plays in redeveloping the properties, but it just, I just think that this site alone is going to be so expensive.
Why not tear it down and get all that land? It's a huge tract of land served by railroads and easy access to the roadways. I would think that if that build, that site were clear, you would have all sorts of potential uses for it. Mm-hmm. You look at it, you know, we talked about the Warner Swayze building years ago. It's hard to reuse these buildings that were designed for a very specific and unusual purpose. But at least we got to see inside it after all these years. I'm wondering what it was like in there. You're listening to Today in Ohio. That's it for Thursday. Come back Friday for a wrap-up discussion of the news. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Laura. Thank you for listening.